Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a special public conversation I'm hosting, and you're invited to join me and several of Charlotte's African-American leaders for Building an Inclusive City. That's on February 21st, 7 p.m. at Spirit Square. We'll be talking with Charlotte's mayor, police chief, city manager, and district attorney. Details and free registration at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you there. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yet another school shooting takes 17 lives in Florida. We get local reaction and look at NRA funding for our state senators. CMPD, the ATF, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Department of Public Safety coordinate efforts to take down 45 violent offenders in Charlotte. Election season opens. Some candidates kick off their campaigns. We'll tell you who's running so far and what races to watch. And education news includes a clash between CMS School Board and the Superintendent over reducing school through to superintendent. For details on those and other stories this hour on the local news roundup, our roundtable of reporters has gathered at Amelie's in Uptown. And because there are macaroons involved, at least we were promised there'd be macaroons involved. Tom Bullock is here.
Good morning.
From WFAE News. Glenn Brookins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Doss Helms.
I'm here for the brownies.
Oh, good. Education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Spanberg. Why are you here?
I have no idea.
He's senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. I would say you'd reach us through email, but I won't get them today, so forget that. But you can watch us on Facebook Live if you like. Okay. On Wednesday, there was yet another shooting at an American high school, this time in Parkland, Florida, on the outskirts of Fort Lauderdale. At last count, and I think the count won't rise, but hopefully it won't rise, another 17 high school students were shot and killed, 14 wounded, all by an expelled student. It was the deadliest such shooting at a school since a gunman attacked an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. In that case, the victims were in the first and second grade. Nothing happened in the aftermath of that shooting. Nothing happened after the other mass casualty shootings that came between Newtown and Fort Lauderdale, including Las Vegas. Is anything likely to happen as the result of this shooting? Tom.
I hope so. I don't mind saying it just like that. I hope so. I really don't know. I mean, if you stop and think about it, when I went into work this morning to kind of, you know, prepare for the show, I vaguely remembered there was another school shooting this year in Western Kentucky where two people were killed and 17 or 18 more wounded. Little did I know, there were, in total, so far this year alone, 18 shootings on school property nationwide. 18, and we are in the middle of February.
Yeah.
I hope something changes, because at this point, you know, prayers will offer condolence, you know, give a little bit of comfort to someone, but it doesn't help the next parent.
Yeah, this is not, by a long shot, the first time that local schools or national schools have reviewed and said, what can we do to keep our kids safer? You know, some things have been done, some more things may be done, but for those of us who remember Columbine and just the raw shock that this happened, you can now feel anger and disgust and grief, but you can't feel that shocked. This has become part of our culture, is mass shootings in general and some of them in schools.
I think there are a lot of people who feel as Tom does that, and we're hoping that something will happen. But in reality, the early indications are that people have pretty much staked out the same positions they staked out after every other shooting, mass shooting. Those who support liberal gun rights are still supporting liberal gun rights, and those who want to see some type of controls put on ownership are still advocating that. I'm not seeing, at least with our elected officials, I'm not seeing any movement. After the Vegas shooting, there we thought there would be something done about bump stocks. There was absolutely nothing done.
Except in South Carolina.
Yeah, but from a federal level, I think you're exactly right, Glenn. It is, and everybody said it. No one is shocked, unfortunately. The comment that stood out that a lot of people have talked about this week was David Hogg, who was a 17-year-old student. Justin Hogg. He was taking video, and he went on CNN, and he said, "We're children. You guys are the adults. work together.
We actually have. We actually have Justin Hogg. Ready? No, it's, oh, you didn't know this. He was on a many network television shows. He was in his AP environmental science class when the shots went off at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School there. Described to the Associated Press what the chaos that ensued after that. And he made it clear that he and his fellow students are children, and it's time for adults to act.
This is not acceptable. This is something that is completely unacceptable and that we need to take action on. We can say all these great things like condolences and saying we're so sorry for your loss is obviously important. But what we need at this point is not to say that anymore, because there shouldn't be any more children that die. We need to take action.
He's smart, he's angry, and he was the first-hand recipient of this last tragic incident. So tell me, is it going to have to come from kids? Should kids, you know, I had an idea last night, and I would advocate this. I think children across the school country should just take a day off.
A student strike.
Student strike.
You know, maybe.
At yesterday's press conference, I can't remember exactly who it was, but someone said he was a state official, perhaps a law enforcement official, who said that it might be left to the next generation to do something, because this generation, he talked about how dysfunctional government had become, and he said that the younger generation is watching, and it would be great if we could do it in this generation, but if not, the next generation would.
I mean, look at it this way. Maybe it has to come from kids, because, and think about how frightening the sentence I'm about to say truly is. We already know all of the politicians' response to the next school shooting.
Right.
The next one, not even just this one. Everything has become so normalized by this, involving these situations, that the script is well known. You can sing from the hymn book. So perhaps it takes something different. Perhaps it takes a big social media push from students. I mean, I'm a proud father. Regular listeners know this. I'm a proud father of two daughters. And it breaks my heart to think that they will, at some point, likely have to go through some kind of training for an active shooting incident on a campus, whether it's in high school, middle school, I hope not elementary school, or college.
But what are they doing at CMS, Ann?
Well, CMS, the superintendent has said that they're going to review all of their safety procedures. He's talking about possibly should there be armed security guards in every school. That would require, he's looking, I think, at state legislative funding for that. There's always this challenge. When there are guns in schools, it's usually a student who has brought one. It's not a mass shooter coming to do the maximum damage. Fortunately, we've not seen that. So the question becomes, how much, given that we are in a time when tax cuts are popular, when resources are tight, should the state legislature say we are going to fund an armed guard in every single school in North Carolina? And what would the trade-off be? They are, of course, reviewing their procedures. You mentioned that there were 17 students died. It was actually several of them were teachers who were literally trying to save their students from an armed assailant. And I think every single teacher out there today is wondering what they might have to do to save their students if an armed attacker walks into their school. It's not likely, but they really are more of a first line of defense in a lot of ways than whatever elaborate security measures we might put in.
You know, we started in on dysfunctional politics and Washington not working, which is all true. But I think if we're going to take a clear look at this, I mean, all of us are culpable to some degree or another, because nothing has changed since Columbine. It keeps getting worse. And as plenty of people have said this week, thoughts and prayers are one thing, but you do have to wonder, why aren't people demanding? I mean, you see polls that show there is a greater call for more sensible gun laws and things like that. A majority of people are calling for that. So why is that not carrying over into actual action?
Money.
Well, I mean, but still, I'm just saying, I don't think you can completely just put this on politicians. You can't absolve the people who elect the politicians from their responsibility, assuming that you agree that things need to be done. And I think most people do.
Eric, polls show that Americans want stronger gun control. They don't want to take weapons away, but they want to make sure they fall into the hands of responsible individuals. And what's stopping that is the NRA and gun manufacturers contributing in large amounts.
But let me just stop you for a second, Mike.
And you can't compete with that as a voter.
That's not true. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I want everybody in this room who's listening, go look at voter participation,
yep,
whether it's local races, state races, federal races. Pretty much America takes every election off other than presidential elections,
yep,
and that's not where these decisions are being made. So that's why I say, you know, those points are all very valid, but I'm just saying, if you really feel like change needs to be made, it's going to take hard work, and that means being engaged more than just one election every 4 years.
Look, we as Americans, we tend to look at elections as if it's some type of duty, or if we vote, we're doing society a favor. Eric is absolutely right. What we're doing is we're contributing, we're lending our voices to creating the kind of nation, the kind of state, the kind of city, the kind of county that we want to live in. I don't know why anyone would not want to have a voice in creating the kind of place where they want to live. Eric is right. Even during presidential elections, voting rates are woefully low, especially when you compare them against some other developed countries where many, many more people turn out to vote.
Tom.
Well, let's look at this. I mean, yeah, three words. Elections have consequences. Both. I mean, this is a point eloquently made by Glenn and Eric. So let's flip this. All right, Republicans control Capitol Hill. They don't want to deal with gun control. They want to say that this is an issue about mental health or cultural changes. Okay, let's grant them that argument just for argument's sake. Then do something about it.
Right.
Step up and do something about mental health. It's one thing to kind of put in a bill and then watch it slowly die. If they truly believe that this is really about trying that more needs to be done on the mental health front, then do it.
Ann.
But Mike, I think you are right that the NRA does play a significant role in this. They are very skilled at not only supporting people who support their stands, but opposing anybody who suggests even the slightest gun control, and doing it in such a way that it comes across not as something that's mainstream, but that's something about unleashing anarchy and chaos and doing a lot of dog whistling about who might be dangerous out there with guns. I mean, I started thinking about what would a serious response beyond thoughts and prayers look like, and what if we had elected officials, bipartisan leaders, saying, we're taking this off the political table. We have to solve this. We won't take NRA money. We won't play the game of using gun violence for political ads. We're going to approach this as a country the way we would if this were an attack by a foreign country.
And there is certainly a mental health aspect to this. In every single incident that we've been talking about from Columbine forward, the person who pulled the trigger was mentally disturbed. It is certainly the case here. But also, I question whether it's just the people pulling the trigger. What's wrong with us? In Florida, you can't drink at 18. But you can go and you can buy an AR-15 assault rifle without background check, without fingerprints being taken, without a waiting period in the state of Florida. What the hell is wrong with us?
Well, and particularly what we're hearing this week is the difference between just, when you look at buying guns, the difficulty of buying a handgun compared to an assault rifle in Florida and other states. I mean, yeah, there is so much to unpack here. And again, it goes into the nitty-gritty of details of elections and policy and really staying on top of these things. I'm not absolving any of the political bodies. I'm just saying I think it is clear it's going to take a much larger collective effort to solve this.
This just floored me. I was listening to an interview on All Things Considered the other day. And this is how bad it's gotten just in Florida. The host was interviewing a reporter from a regional paper, Palm Beach, and she had covered 3 mass shootings in 3 years. She's 23 years old. This is her first job out of college. She's already covered 3 mass shootings. Hmm. That's frightening.
Tom Bullock is here along with Ann Dulles-Helms, Eric Spanberg, and Glenn Birkins. We're all here at Amelie's in Uptown Charlotte for the local news roundup. We'll come back and talk more about this and other issues as well as we go through the hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. We're at Amelie's. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Tony Ulcher joins us on Twitter. He says, things might finally change. Things are different this time. because we've seen the bodies and heard the shots and screams. In the past, the media had rarely shown the true horror of what happened. Really? Has the coverage been different? Did I miss it? I didn't see any of those things.
I'm not sure it's been different. In Columbine, we saw some footage there. I think the person who sent the tweet might be on to something. This was the first time I watched yesterday's press conference. I've been a journalist for 30 some years, and I've covered a lot of really sad, bad things. This was the first time I saw public officials wiping tears at a press conference.
Well, President Obama did, didn't he, after the Sandy Hook?
Yeah. He did. But, I mean, school officials, local police officials, with tears coming down their faces. But, you know, I thought things would be different after Sandy Hook, with second and third graders.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's the thought that keeps going through my head is the kids that were all under seven in Connecticut in 2012, I really thought that had shaken all of us so badly that it would change. And I'm like everyone else. I hope I'm completely wrong and that this is something that finally moves us as a society to make schools safe for kids again.
And I think the American media are very reluctant to show graphic photos, whether it be television or newspapers.
We should do it.
I think
enough
that,
of this
that
nonsense.
They should be, every
we are
single
not
body, there ought to
snowflakes.
Be a job sent to every elected
We can
elected
see
people.
What's happened in the news. If the photographer can see it, we should be able to see it. And the same is true in these wars we're conducting overseas. All right, no one's going to comment on that.
Well, here,
that's fine. I'm angry this morning, as you can probably tell.
And you're not alone. I mean, the reality of it is if that is what it takes, then it's worth discussing. But I think even more importantly than just images is where's the discussion? Everybody is just trenching to their sides. That is not good enough anymore. I'm like everybody else. You know, I saw Columbine and thought, wow, I will never see something else like that. I sadly was wrong. I saw Newtown and thought, holy cow, nope. You know, so what is it that's going to break what's going to break the script? I mean, is it going to be the direct tweets to President Donald Trump from students who survived? I don't know, but whatever it is, the conversation has to take place because we can't do it unilaterally regardless of which side it is.
So the alleged perpetrator who has confessed, Nicholas Cruz, used an AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle. The National Rifle Association has called the AR-15, quote, the most popular rifle in America, and estimates Americans now own more than 8 million of them. The NRA says the AR-15 has soared in popularity because it's, quote, customizable, adaptable, reliable, and accurate. It's the same rifle used by Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook. It's the same rifle that Omar Mateen used to kill 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. It's the same rifle used by Stephen Paddock in Las Vegas. Devin Kelly also had an AR-15-style Ruger on him when he shot 26 people at that church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. So aside from using these weapons quite successfully in mass shootings, what else are they used for?
Go ahead.
I don't know anything of significant value that they are used for. I'm sure gun enthusiasts use them for target practice or whatever, but they're not hunting weapons, and you certainly don't need an AR-15 to protect.
I mean, somebody said yesterday, if you are a gun enthusiast and you want a military-style assault weapon, join the military.
Yeah. You know, but I think you hit on a point. Even if we stopped producing these guns today, there are so many out there that we would not see an immediate decline, not necessarily, because we have so many guns in our society.
True.
Not just AR-15s, but handguns and all types of different guns. Granted, the AR-15 has become, it seems, the weapon of choice for those who want to perpetrate evil. But there are just so many guns in our society today.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The one good thing that may have come out of this, and this is a pejorative statement on my part, and I admit, I'm prejudiced here, is that Sheriff Carmichael has canceled his raffle at which he was going to raffle off an AR-15 or two.
Among other weapons, yeah. And that's, You know, that's an interesting thing.
It's our sheriff here.
Yeah, that's Sheriff Mecklenburg County Sheriff Irwin Carmichael. It was part of a campaign, you know, way to raise campaign money because he's running for re-election this year. And his statement was pretty blunt and said, you know, out of respect for the families, I'm sorry that this happened. Obviously, this is a bad idea. I still, though, again, there have been 18 gun incidents, shootings on college or school campuses in 2018. You know, there were, Kentucky was, again, it seems like forever ago, but it was weeks ago. I'm surprised that it took that long for him to decide this is probably not a good thing. And I'm as happy to see it. I don't think that you should be doing gun raffles. This is my personal opinion. I don't think gun raffles are an appropriate campaign finance thing. There are plenty of other wonderful things that you can...
Why would a sheriff's department be wanting to put more assault rifles on the street that are likely to be used against their own personnel?
You can't say they're likely to be used against their own personnel. I understand your point, Mike.
Could be used.
But I seriously doubt that it's going to be the people who are paying, you know, the $50 for a raffle ticket.
All right.
But I think the point is valid that rarely do you see a law enforcement official wanting to put more guns on the street. Most of them are advocating for fewer firearms on the street. The other thing I would say, I didn't find his statement blunt at all. In fact, I found it kind of muddled. I wasn't sure exactly what he was trying to say, especially toward the end when he talked about that it went against his beliefs or whatever. I don't know if he meant the raffle went against what he believed in, and I think this is going to hurt him in his reelection.
I was going to say, I will be interested to see if this becomes a campaign issue. Obviously, he has, I think, two challengers, so that will be interesting to see if this galvanizes a discussion in that direction.
So Mary Beth tweets, my daughter began active shooter drills at her preschool at age 3. Mike asked the right question. What is wrong with our society that we allow this type of sickness to continue? New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote of the Florida shooting this week, inevitably, predictably, fatefully, another mass shooting breaks our hearts. I think he's wrong about that. Our hearts are not broken. We don't care. If we cared, we would do something about this.
I would have to agree with you there. I think when we do start to care,
just another broken day in America, and we move on.
I think it's cliche, but it has become the new norm for us, unfortunately. And it's not just in schools. We're talking about schools now. But churches right here in Charlotte are hiring armed guards, are hiring off-duty police officers to patrol their campuses to keep them safe during Sunday morning service. We saw it first after the Charleston shooting, then we saw it again after the shooting, I guess it was in Texas, the church shooting. But it's not just schools. We are seeing every sector of our society now increasingly concerned about these types of incidents. I know when I go to a movie theater, I'm looking for the exit. Where is the exit in case something happens? And it hasn't always been the case.
And I think that's in combination with how life changed after 9/11 as well. With airport security, sporting events, certainly. I mean, it is just everything is much different in terms of day-to-day life and the security needs and demands based on what's going on.
And it does become a question of how much do you fortify everything? Because if somebody is truly coming in heavily armed to do damage, it takes a lot to keep them out. There was a round of reviews at Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools a few years ago after another tragic school shooting, and one of the things they considered, they did do a much better job of locking all the front doors. I used to be able to just walk into a school. I can't do that now. But one of the things they considered was putting fences around these campuses that have multiple buildings, because newer schools are one building, and that's easier to lock down and keep people out. But when you've got 6 or 7 buildings over multiple acres, they said, well, maybe we should put a fence around it. And there were some legitimate safety questions, like what if the person got in and then people couldn't get away from the campus? But you also heard from people who said, this is going to be ugly in our neighborhood, and we don't want that. So literally every question becomes, how much do we respond by fortifying everything we care about?
Well, let me give you an example. I was talking with a local pastor here in Charlotte. I won't mention his name or the church, and they are in the process of reviewing their budget to see if they can get armed off-duty police officers. And the initial thought was to hire one. But then they were saying, well, what if that one gets in trouble? What if someone comes in with a high-powered assault-type rifle? Maybe we need more than one. So, you know, this is it's spiraling to a place where I don't think we want to be as a country.
We're talking to Dan Rather on this program on Monday, former anchor of the CBS Evening News, and 86 years old. He's had a 30,000-foot view for quite a long time. And we're not going to talk about this, but I had a chance to talk to him yesterday about this. Here's his take. In the aftermath of the shooting at the high school near Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on Wednesday, you wrote, I guess on Facebook, "Sadness and despair, those were my first reactions. But then quickly, I am hopping mad." And you go on to say that this is not normal. We seem to be living all shades of not normalcy anymore. How do you explain all these mass shootings in the last several years, and it doesn't faze us?
Frankly, I'm not sure, but I do know that this is not okay. As I wrote in that post, it's not okay. This is not normal. That we're losing about 33,000 Americans a year to gun deaths. We can't call ourselves a fully civilized society and have this go forward.
And it is never a good time to talk about guns.
As a personal opinion, I think we have to talk about it. When it comes to gun violence in schools, we can't just continue to throw up our hands. As I tried to write, it's all good to have thoughts and prayers for the families of the victims, but we have to respond in some other positive ways. And I do think that there's got to be a way to reach at least some beginning common ground about guns. Look, we're a country of guns. We're a gun culture. We have been, we are now, and for the foreseeable future, while a lot of people don't like it, we will remain basically a gun culture. The question is, what steps are we going to take that will at least reduce the number of incidents we have, such as happened in Florida? It's unimaginable to me that we Americans can't find some answers to this gun violence. But let's face it, up to and including the present time, we haven't.
Is it going to have to come from the people, or is it going to come from a politician?
No, it has to come from the people. It isn't going to come from people in political power because, quite honestly, and there's no gentle way to say this, that many of the people in political power, both federal and local, are bought and paid for by money from gun manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers. Whatever solutions, and there isn't going to be any magic solution, but whatever even beginning solutions have to come from the people up, you aren't going to get it from the state capitol and from Washington.
Dan Rather, who will join us for the hour on Monday. Dan, yesterday at a press conference, CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox talked about increasing security at the CMS schools in terms of increasing police presence and changing the locks on the doors.
I think one of the things that we have to look at is, you know, do we have to have different locking mechanisms on our door? Do we have to provide individual classrooms with locking mechanisms that can't be easily accessed? Those things cost money. I think the one thing that we can also ask our legislature to help us with is school security services in the form of armed security officers. I think that is an unfortunate reality of the 21st century, that we not only have to secure our facilities more adequately, but we also have to provide armed security in many times, or at least with very quick resource.
Wilcox also said he would like to see CMPD be more visible at area schools, and WBTV got CMPD Chief Putney's response to that.
I think we're very visible already because we have SROs at all the high schools, and obviously we're stepping up our patrols in light of what's happened so that we can meet that need. We totally agree with them. That's why we're a good partner with CMS and CMS law enforcement to have that visibility, but also to make sure we have a plan in place in case something happens so that we can react with a focused plan that could resolve a situation.
And Kerr Putney reiterated his, if you see something, say something philosophy.
What we're trying to do is really tap into the social media realm and have people, when you see something in social media that you know is outside the norm, that you know could lead to violence, you let us know. Take a screenshot, get it to an adult, get it to us so that we can be more proactive. We want to continue to say, if you see something on social media that you know could lead to violence, you got to let us know. Let's not wait and react to something. Let's prevent it.
So is this going to set parents' mind at ease, students' mind at ease, teachers' minds at ease, Anne?
No. In fact, I would guess that today is a very difficult day for everybody because, and the young man who did this shooting, there were all sorts of signs from social media to his history of having been kicked out of this school. He was in a special school for young people with severe problems. You just know that every school, there are these discussions going on about, well, what about so-and-so? He seems like the kind who would do this. There are rumors flying. I think there are probably parents who are scared to death to send their kids in. I think there are teachers, again, who are saying, we just watched a colleague in Florida or two or three colleagues in Florida lay down their lives because of an active shooter. I don't know that there's anything that you can do that can put minds at ease, but I think the stress level this week is extraordinarily high.
As Dan Rather has said, and as some of us have said, this is going to have to be a groundswell. It's going to have to come from the people, not from politicians. The New York Times published a list recently of the top 10 senators and top 10 House members getting funding from the NRA. Two of the senators are from North Carolina. Number two on the list, Richard Burr. Number four on the list, Tom Tillis. Why is North Carolina getting so much money? There are senators getting so much money from the NRA. We're talking about nearly $7 million to Richard Burr and $4 million to Tom Tillis.
Almost $4.5 million.
$4.5 million.
I think, to give a little context to this, too, number one on that list, the only person getting more than a North Carolina senator is Arizona Senator John McCain, and that includes the money the NRA helped, you know, gave him or ran on his behalf when he ran for president. So there is a skew there. So, you know, Richard Burr being number two is significant. Now, part of that is because of the fact he's been in Congress in one form or another since, what, 1994? So he's got a long time up there. He is a big gun proponent, you know, gun rights proponent. Tom Tillis is probably a little surprising to everyone.
And they faced serious challenges. And a lot of that money was not just, yay, vote for these guys. It was, beware of these challengers who are going to come take your guns away, which, again, is very much part of this dynamic.
I think a big part of this is that it's a purple state and we have these close races. I'm sorry, Tom.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some other things in the news that happened this week. Yes, there were other things that happened. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you today from Amelie's in Uptown Charlotte. I haven't seen a single macaroon yet. I don't know what we're going to do about this. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE. That's all the reason he came. Andos Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal.
Mike, it's torturous because I can actually see them making delicious pastries, but they're not.
Eric, that's why I sat here, so I wouldn't have to watch. Yeah.
Well played.
Other news this week, 45 people were arrested this week and are in jail in Charlotte as part of a coordinated takedown effort on the part of CMPD and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and other law enforcement entities. Why Charlotte? Why these 45 individuals?
Well, I mean, the short answer is they were here and we have a violent crime task force. And Charlotte still remains a major transit point, kind of a hub for everything from, you know, drugs and the sex trade and all sorts of things. We like to think of ourselves as a nice southern city. We've got some pretty disturbing, you know, roots. So this federal task force, which combined FBI, DEA, CMPD, and other agencies, had targeted these people who are repeat felons with something, I mean, hundreds of convictions between them. And they rounded them up and found, you know, the usual things of drugs and money and guns. But to me, what was even more disturbing was the fact that they also found body armor. We're talking bulletproof vests. These are not things that you just simply go out and buy.
Yeah, Kerr Putney called that troubling.
I agree, 100%, because if you think about body armor, you know, inherently that makes it harder for the police and first responders in a shootout to have a chance because, you know, the CMPD officers are equipped, but they, I don't know the grade of the body armor. I'd be curious to see if they were actually nicer or not as good as CMPDs. They didn't say.
This was part of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' reinvigoration of Project Safe Neighborhoods. It's part of it was a wrap-up of an eight-month investigation. How often do these raids take place? Do we know?
Okay. It's hard to say, but, I mean, we also had a big gang raid not all that long ago. Right. So it seems that at least in cities like Charlotte that do have these task forces, movement is underway.
So tensions flared this week between – this is an odd story, and I hope you can explain it to me, Ann. Tensions flared this week between the CMS school board and CMS's new superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, after his staff followed the orders of the school board to reduce K through 2 suspensions. Those suspensions were dramatically reduced from 367 in, I think, last year to only 48 in the same stretch of time this year. So what's the point of friction? They did what they were asked to do.
Well, and I think that was why Dr. Wilcox felt sort of frustrated. He had gotten this mandate, and it was actually kind of slipped in this the part that said he had to review any recommended suspension, which increased his workload a good bit. So that was slipped in. It was not on the agenda. It was a last-minute revision. So they were required to do quarterly reports. This was the second one. I think he thought the school board was going to stand up and say, job well done, and they did to a certain extent.
Nobody's, one of them stood up and said, this is too good to be true.
Yes, that phrase came up at least twice, and you had questions really from two different perspectives. Erica Ellis Stewart, who has been really the driving force behind this in terms of stopping what's called the school-to-prison pipeline, the idea that any student, but especially disproportionately young black boys, are being labeled as troublemakers or being kicked out of school at very young ages, often for things like disruptive behavior or aggressive behavior that's sort of a judgment call. So she was saying, well, these numbers look good, but convince me that they're real, that this is not just sort of a surface job. And then Ruby Jones, who is a retired teacher, has been worried about, well, we can't just ban this. There was actually talk of saying, you cannot suspend any child below third grade. And she said, if you've been in those classrooms, there are children who have really serious behavior issues that disrupt all of their classmates. So she was saying, make sure that we're not just keeping the disruptive kids in class and still damaging the learning environment for so many other children.
Alarm bells must also be going off both in CMS and also in Wake County schools, because there might be a move afoot in Raleigh to change things, shall we say. There's a legislative committee looking into whether large school districts, and we are one of the largest, are effective. The committee is a bipartisan committee, but Mecklenburg Democratic State Senator Joyce Waddell, who's on it, says she's against what the committee is assigned to do, which is to break up the CMS system. Is that true? Is that what they're assigned to do?
The committee is not assigned to break it up. The committee,
that's what she says.
Well, she was mistaken on that.
Okay.
She's
on the committee.
Well, what they are charged with doing is coming up essentially with recommendations for a process. If one were to want to do this, how would it be done? Would it require a referendum? Would it require a certain number of signatures? And the report by law is due on May 1st, so I am inclined to think they'll probably take that mandate fairly narrowly and say, here is a procedure. But the bigger questions really are, where has this been done? What can we say about projections in terms of cost? I think it would be significantly costly. What could we expect in terms of challenges and or benefits academically, socially? And there is a desegregation, resegregation element to all of this, in that the areas that tend to want to say, we'd like to have our own smaller district, tend to be richer and whiter than the larger entity that they're part of.
Are her suspicions perhaps fueled by who the co-chair of the committee is? And the co-chair is Republican Bill Brawley, who, as we all know, was one of the forces behind trying to give Matthews and Mint Hill the right to start their own charter school. Break away from.
And this is a long-standing dynamic. You know, as long as you and I have both been around, I think there have been suburban residents in Mecklenburg County saying, essentially, Charlotte is bossing us around and dragging us down. We would like to separate. And it's never been concrete enough, again, to get into those details of how it would play out. So whether this is leverage, whether this is a weapon to say, if you don't do what we like, we might split off, or whether this is, would someday, there are still a whole lot of steps that would have to happen before this could get close to being reality. But the question is, will it someday become a reality?
So there are 9 Republicans on this 12-member committee. Is the outcome a foregone conclusion, or could they actually say maintain the status quo?
I suppose they could. I think it would be surprising if they did not come up and say, here are some things. If the General Assembly as a whole wants to take this step and spell out a process, here are some steps. They, again, are not going to come in and say, we recommend splitting up Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools in 2019.
What has been the reaction at CMS and or Wake County?
Well, the district officials, of course, don't like it. It's complicates their lives extremely. And when you talk about things like a petition or a referendum, it does pose the question, what if a small subgroup were very strongly in favor of it? Say, you know, pick any given suburb in Mecklenburg County, and they were 100% in favor of doing this, but it has ramifications for the entire countywide district. So if I think the question would be, does the entire county have to sign off on saying, sure, we're going to carve off, you know, we're going to split into three or four, or we're going to give this suburb permission to go its own way or whatever?
What I'm about to say actually surprised me when I read it yesterday. Eastland Mall, we're going to change gears here now. Eastland Mall has been closed for 8 years. It seems like 20 or 30 to me, but it's been closed for 8 years. At this point, it seems as though it never really existed. So imagine our surprise to hear that this week, city leaders believe that they are closer to finding a long-term solution for that 80-acre site. It can't be a movie studio. We've already been down that road.
Yeah.
Is it a luge? What is it?
You know, this is like the Scooby-Doo episode where there's a mystery. I think I've written this story so many times in the last 5 or 6 years. They have switched processes. They have looked at various different ways. What the city is trying to do now is to pick a so-called master developer to hire this spring to then, who would then figure out exactly how to attract the private investment that
Wait a minute. See, what you're saying is this big announcement this week is that we're going back to ground zero.
Well, Well, they've gone a little bit beyond starting over. They actually have three private firms who are interested, which is more than they've had in a while. So what they have to figure out is who's going to do the planning. And then secondly, and I think the really big and interesting question here is, what is the city willing to provide? Because it's in a part of town that doesn't have the affluence to attract private investment, which means the city's going to have to spruce up the landscaping. They may have to do things to roads, utilities, whatever they can do to make the site cheaper for people to develop on. And then remember, the city owns this land. They paid $13 million for the property back in 2012. Will they just give the land to the people who develop? Will they steeply discount it? Will they lease it? I mean, so there are all these particulars that are going to come into play.
So this will come out as they hire this. They haven't hired the person yet.
They have not.
They will hire this private developer who will come up ideas, solutions, and work out
Correct.
The details.
Correct. And now they already have Sounds proposals like- from the developer that they're looking at to see what the developer has in mind, and they have to then recommend to the council. So we'll see.
Okay. Election filing season is open. It began, I think, this week. Is that right? Candidates
Monday.
Are off
Monday.
Running. Who's running? We have 10 incumbents. Are they all running? Legislators,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, and, you know, it's this is an interesting primary. Everybody's expected to run, at least in Mecklenburg, to run for re-election. But one thing that'll be interesting, besides being midterms, which always, you know, are just second below presidential years, this is an odd primary in the fact that for the first time in decades, there will be no statewide races on anybody's ballot. And that is due to a combination of factors, most notably the postponement of judicial primaries or canceling of judicial primaries, so you don't have, appellate court judges getting elected this year. But it's going to be an interesting race because there are lots of questions about this election season. I mean, most notably, you know, will there be a Democratic wave like we saw in Virginia? Will there be some kind of counteract to that? But the thing I'm most interested in is watching really something that was, started being bandied about last year in 2017, which is this going to be the year of the female candidate from either party?
Yeah, because they're underrepresented both in the House of in the Congress, and they're represented in the State House. They make up 51 point something of the population.
51.4%.
And how many women are in the legislature?
About 25%.
25%. Have there been more female candidates declaring?
Well, it's hard to say.
So far.
Yeah, it's hard to say because the window goes until February 28th. But I will use this statistic as something that I thought was really interesting. On the first day of filing, there were 38 women who filed candidacy just for the state legislature. There are only 43 women who currently serve in either the House or Senate in North Carolina combined. So that's just five fewer women who you know, announced their candidacy on Monday than the total number that served. That's pretty impressive.
I was going to say the other thing, and I think Tom was hinting at this, this is the so-called blue moon cycle in North Carolina where you don't have a governor's race or a U.S. Senate race. And so one of the things we were talking earlier about voter participation, well, typically when you don't have one of those offices on the ballot during a midterm, voter participation goes down. So that will be playing against, is there truly more momentum, particularly with the Democrats? A lot of people are saying there is. We'll see in terms of turnout with this midterm election.
Totally.
More information has begun to seep out about what various municipalities were offering Amazon to lure them to town. Governor Roy Cooper tried to convince Amazon that our state is inclusive and would be a good fit for them, even if some of our politicians are living, quote, in the 1950s. He said, like every family with an embarrassing uncle or two, we have a few politicians who want it to be 1957 instead of 2017. That doesn't sound like the normal phraseology or phraseology that one would use to attract a big business to a state.
I think you're trying to tempt one of us into saying the phrase that will make us drop a dollar in the jar and have to give up a macaroon. Because it was in response to a certain House bill that generated quite a lot of controversy.
Well, that's quite a recruiting pitch, though. Look at us. We're not that bad.
That's right. That seeped out because of Hickory's bid. Evidently, Hickory's leaking some of their details. And one of the other details is that Hickory, because they were also passed over, Hickory would like to be called the Greater Hickory Metro, Charlotte's Great Northwest.
Think of it like Charlotte's Canada, I guess. I'm not really sure.
Is flannel going to be big up there now?
Apparently. Maybe they'll start a hockey team. I started my story with that because it just struck me as quite funny. But I have to say, you keep using the term that this is seeping out. I actually find the tactics used to get this information to be brilliant. It was actually the Triangle Business Journal who first broke it, and they got information we've all been trying to get by doing a Freedom of Information Act request, not at the state level, but at the local county level in a county no one had been focused on. It was fascinating.
Wow. So are they going to actually put that up on a billboard or something? The Great Hickory Metro, Charlotte's Great Northwest.
Ah, don't.
Do you have the T-shirt yet?
We'll be Hickory's Great Southeast. That'll be good. The CIAA tournament, which is about to come back to town, returns, I think, is it this month or next?
It is February 27th.
They've cut the seating in half at Spectrum Center for this event. I don't know why. There are new government policies that are very carefully permitting where you can have parties because they want to control any potential violence. And the CIAA is now saying there's no guarantee that they'll come back after their current agreement ends in 2020.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Well, they've been here 13 years so far. They moved the league headquarters here. And I think one of the things they're trying to do is, frankly, just get a better deal. And so they're going to go out there and see what other cities will offer.
I want to thank Eric Spanberg for joining us here today, and from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Berkins from Key City Metro will be joining me next week, and you're invited to join us as well for a special public conversation with the mayor, the district attorney, the police chief, and the city manager. We'll be next Wednesday evening at 7.
Looking forward to it.
At Spirit Square, free registration at WFAE.org. We should have a meeting before we do the show together.
Let's do that.
Okay, we'll do that. Thanks to Lynn here in our audience for buying all these macaroons that suddenly made an appearance. And
thank you, Lynn.
And this is Tom Bullock's last participation in the news roundup. His parents even came for this.
Hi, guys.
Because he's going off to a new job and hopefully greener pastures. We will miss you desperately. Thank you for doing it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all for the hour.